Hi, friends. How are we doing today? Well, I am glad you came to church. Today we continue a series called The Life and Lyrics of David. We're studying the life of David as God guides him from his anointing in Bethlehem to his ascension in Jerusalem. And while we read David's story in 1 and 2 Samuel, we're learning directly from David in his Psalms. The songs that reveal his prayers and his pain as his story unfolds. Before we catch up with David in 1 Samuel 19, why don't we take a moment and invite God to speak to us? Will you join your hearts with me? Lord, as we read more of David's story today, we'll read an honest psalm. So, we'll pray an honest prayer. We see you working around us, but not where we want to see you working. We hear you speaking, but you're not saying what we want to hear. So, we pray this. Give us faith to trust you where we cannot see you, when we cannot hear you. May this story of David remind us that we can put our hope in you right here, right now, and it's the very best thing we could do. We pray this in the name of King Jesus. Amen. On January 29, our world was rocked by the social media post of a 3.5-year-old. On that cold Monday morning, Elmo asked a simple question. Elmo was just checking in. How is everybody doing? Well, within 24 hours, Elmo's post racked up almost 140 million views and thousands of comments. To be sure, some of the responses were snarky, but a surprising number of replies got real and raw and vulnerable with Elmo. Some people posted about their experience of deep and dark discouragement. Others shared their feelings of dread that filled their mind and flooded their souls, making them not want to get out of bed or go right back to bed. Experts speculated on why Elmo's post got so much attention. Maybe it was because some people grew up with them, and their bond from childhood gave them permission to be honest about their feelings and their fears. Or maybe they simply trusted Elmo's non-judgmental posture of gentleness and curiosity and empathy. The next day, Elmo replied, "Wow!" Elmo was glad he asked. Elmo learned that it is important to ask a friend how they are doing. Elmo will check in again soon, friends. Elmo loves you. You have someone you can open up to when you're hurting or hopeless. Oh, I pray that you do. And if you don't, I pray that you find that someone soon. That's one of my great goals as a pastor, that every one of you would find two or three of your BFFs, your closest spiritual friends, right here within our church community. A spiritual friend is someone who helps you find strength in God. A spiritual friend is someone who helps you pay attention to God when God seems to blend into the background. Oh, I pray you find a spiritual friend with whom you can be vulnerable when you're helpless or hurting or hopeless. But how vulnerable do you get with God? Okay, for some of you, the very question may stretch your faith. Maybe you're new to faith, and you don't have a framework for what I'm talking about. Or maybe your faith is honestly just old and crusty and weary and worn. And the concept of opening yourself up to God sounds like a complete waste of time and energy. At least that's been your experience. Well, friends, look. Elmo's great and all. It's just, I have found God to be a really good listener. And I found you can train yourself to listen to him too. It's something David learned to do. And he learned it the hard way. So did I. Most of you know my friend Jeff Lucas. Jeff's that zany British bloke I bring in to speak on occasion. And Jeff wears many hats in life. He's a pastor and preacher. Half the year he serves in England, where he ministers in local churches and hosts a radio show. But Jeff's also a life coach. He's a certified instructor of a program called Life Plan. A life plan's a powerful tool used by leaders to look at their past and their present in order to shape their future. And it usually costs thousands of dollars to do a life plan. But Jeff emailed me one afternoon about a decade ago, and he asked, "Troy, can I do your life plan for free?" Now, I've told some of you about my experience. I hop on a plane to Colorado where Jeff and I sit in a room together for 2 days talking about my dreams and my disappointments. My trusted friend digs deep into my soul there to unearth truths about who I am and what God is doing in me. Jeff records all my information on giant post-it notes that he hangs all around the room. By the end of our time together, I'm literally surrounded by my story. And everywhere I look, I see God's fingerprints. Jeff there created a history of my life. He mapped the ups and downs. We laughed together. We cried together. We thanked God together. And we made a list of lessons I've learned by looking backward. Here are a few of them. First, God is with me. Always has been, always will be. This, friends, is probably the most important thing you'll ever learn about me, though it's not unique to me. If you've journeyed long enough with Jesus, you've probably found it to be true of you, even when you couldn't see him. He was there. The next lesson caught me off guard. Critical life decisions may be made surprisingly early in life. Now, that lesson took me by surprise. And frankly, it was Jeff who made the observation. It was my life, but I never noticed it before. Jeff looked with me at the storyboard of my life on the wall, and he began to weigh all my decisions. Well, once we saw them in totality, Jeff asked, "Troy, did you notice that the most important decisions of your life were all made between the ages of 18 and 21? He was right. And that's weird. Okay? Jeff had never seen that before. So take heart if you're 22. But it's true for me. Critical life decisions may be made surprisingly early in life. During that stretch of time, I made some big ones. My choice of a college, my shift to pastoral ministry, my decision to break up with a girl, my decision to date a girl, my decision to marry that girl, my decision to move to Utah. My most significant life-altering decisions were all made before I turned 22. Here's another lesson I learned early on. It is my responsibility to know God in every season. Now, this principle has perhaps shaped my life's trajectory more than all others. It is my responsibility to know God in every season, in agony and achievement. I've learned I have to look for the Lord. Now, friends, that's easier said than done, especially when you're broke or brokenhearted. That's easier said than done if you're battling anxiety or battling depression or battling your spouse in a messy divorce. In a season like that, it's difficult to take responsibility to know God. Which brings us to another principle we concluded from my life plan. It's a corollary to the one before it. Let your drama drive you to God. Now, I began to experience the value of that principle at an early age. I was just a little guy, first, second, third grade. And I was afraid. Because of some difficulties in my family, a cloud of darkness settled over my young life. During that season, I spent countless nights alone in my room, crying myself to sleep, afraid of the future. But I remembered in Sunday school, a teacher taught me about the Psalms. She told me about these ancient songs that became the prayers of God's people through the ages. So, one night, I began praying those Psalms for myself. See, the psalmists taught me how to pray when I was just learning to read. And God used their words to shape my soul and teach me to trust. See, that's my prayer for you today. I pray you let your drama drive you to God. Not everyone does. People tend to respond to tragedy in two ways. They run to God or they run from God. Rarely is there a response that's not extreme. What I'm saying is, you get a choice. David made a choice. In our series thus far, our heroes lived on top of the world. David's embodied the classic rags-to-riches story. The shepherd boy, overlooked by father and family, chosen to be king over Israel instead of King Saul. In his youth, David became the ancient equivalent of a rock star, a gifted musician from an early age. Young David became a favorite entertainer in the court of the king. Success followed David wherever he went, on the field of battle, while others in Israel cowered in their tents. David modeled faith and trust, running out to face Goliath with only a sling and a stone. As a warrior, David became a legend in his own time. The people sang songs about him. The whole nation adored him. As he thrived on the battlefield, he flourished in relationships. David found a friend like no other in Jonathan, the beloved prince. And to top it off, he married the princess. Success and blessing and honor chased David wherever he went. But none of that escaped the attention of King Saul. David's success fueled Saul's jealousy, which gave way to Saul's fear. Eventually, the subtle machinations of the king evolved into a murderous rage. And that brings us to 1 Samuel 19, verse 1. Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan had taken a great liking to David and warned him, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there." Then Jonathan pledges to serve as a mediator between his friend and his father. See, Jonathan comes to David, and he probably thinks he can fix this. Give me a chance, David. Jonathan spoke well, verse 4 of David, to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He has not wronged you, and what he has done has benefited you greatly." Literally in Hebrew, Jonathan pleads, "Don't sin against David. He hasn't sinned against you." Saul's moved by the words of his son. Saul listened to Jonathan and took this oath. "As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death." This, by the way, is the most potent and potentially blasphemous vow one could make. Because if Saul breaks that vow, he's calling into question the very existence of God. No surprise, Saul's good intentions are short-lived. Our narrator tells us an evil spirit from the Lord came on Saul as he was sitting in his house with the spear in his hand. While David was playing the lyre, Saul tried to pin him to the wall with the spear, but David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. That night, David made good his escape. Now, we talked about the mystery of this evil spirit earlier in the series when we studied chapter 16 and chapter 18. If you missed those messages and you'd like a little more explanation about this malady and God's role in Saul's experience of it, you can look for those messages on our website, capitalchurch.com. Well, in response, our narrator tells us David determines to hit the road. However, Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, warned him, "If you don't run for your life tonight, Tomorrow you will be killed. Now, remember, David's wife is Saul's daughter, but the princess clings to her husband over her father, just like her brother Jonathan. Verse 12, so Michal let David down through a window, and he fled and escaped. Then Michal took an idol and laid it on the bed, covering it with a garment and putting some goat's hair at the head. Now, if you're wondering what an idol is doing in the house of David, you're asking a good question. Some scholars question Michal's faithfulness to God. Others wonder if our narrator's being cheeky. Old Testament scholar Bill Arnold suggests that the narrative may be using a derisive tone, as if idols are good for nothing but the occasional trick. But whatever the case, Saul's men don't disrupt the sick man, which is baffling since they plan to kill him. Perhaps they don't want to get what he got. But look, it's all a ruse to buy time. And Saul won't have it. He demands the men drag David to him, bed and all. But when they do, they find only an idol covered in goat hair. Saul confronts his daughter, who lies. Verse 17, Michal told him, he said to me, let me get away. Why should I kill you? Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann observes, we seem to be reading a dime store novel or watching a seedy soap opera. There is nothing here of God, of God's will, or God's coming kingdom. We are treated to calculating human actions that do not conform to our expectations. Something is deeply awry when a future king must crawl through a window, when the wife of a coming king must lie to the father who is still king. The evil spirit of Saul has infected the whole scene. Now, in the texts that follow, we find four stories of David on the run. Our narrator uses almost identical language to introduce each of them. First, David runs to the prophet Samuel, who's mentoring a school of prophets. When David had fled and made his escape, he went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. But Saul discovers David's location, and the bizarre series of events follows. Verse 19. Word came to Saul, David is at Naoth in Ramah, so he sent men to capture him. But when they saw a group of prophets prophesying with Samuel standing there as their leader, the Spirit of God came on Saul's men, and they also prophesied. Saul was told about it, and he sent more men, and they prophesied too. Saul sent men a third time, and they also prophesied. The spiritual experience has raised a lot of questions for interpreters. The point is, Saul's men are so distracted by a supernatural experience that they're unable to accomplish their mission. After three envoys from the king fail, Saul takes it upon himself to journey to Ramah. Here's what happens. So Saul went to Naoth and Ramah, but the Spirit of God came even on him, and he walked along prophesying until he came to Naoth. He stripped off his garments, and he too prophesied in Samuel's presence. Look at this. He lay naked all that day and all that night. This is why people say, is Saul among the prophets? What the jack is going on in this story? Now, when we read 1 Samuel 18, we saw that one's robe signified one's identity. Well, what does it mean if the king of Israel lies immobile, naked, and incapacitated by a work of God? I think it's a not-so-subtle reminder that God has made up his mind to dethrone and disgrace Saul while he raises up another. Again, Walter Brueggemann writes, the pitifully embarrassing scene is that of this once great man, still tall, but no longer great, exhausted by demanding religious exercise, clearly not in control, shamed, now rendered powerless in a posture of submissiveness. The episode is an act of dramatic delegitimation of Saul. Well, What's the purpose of all this beyond Saul? Think about it. It buys David time to escape again. Eugene Peterson sums it up nicely. He, meaning Saul, has fallen under the spell of goodness and is rendered temporarily incapable of evil. I like that. Then, when we come to chapter 20, we find more evidence of the friendship between David and Jonathan. And this chapter stands out because of its fierce, emotionally charged dialogue. Then David fled from Naioth at Ramah and went to Jonathan and asked, "What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he's trying to kill me?" Jonathan doesn't know what he's talking about. He thinks everything's fine between him and his father. Surely he would have heard if things were different with Dad. Well, to prove his point, David devises a plan to test Saul's loyalty. When he's invited to a feast the next day, David believes his absence will out Saul's anger. So when the feast begins, without David present, Saul inquires about David as Jonathan covers for him. But our narrator tells us, Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you?" Somebody's going to say that to somebody later today, aren't you? "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman." It was actually a vulgar insult in ancient Hebrew. And Saul uses it to lash out at his son and his wife. "Oh, the king knows what's at stake. As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send someone to bring him to me, for he must die." Jonathan protests, "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" Jonathan asked his father, but Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. That clued him in, apparently. After Jonathan gives his friend the bad news, the two friends weep with one another. The chapter ends with a simple, sad verse. "Then David left, and Jonathan went back to the town. Jonathan returns to his home. Well, David's got nowhere to go. He's run to his wife. He's run to Samuel. He's run to his BFF. Now he's running out of options. In verse 1 of chapter 21, David went to Nom, to Ahimelech, the priest. Now, next week, and we plan to examine the dialogue between David and the priest of Nob, Ahimelech. But knowing Saul can't be far behind, David doesn't linger long in Nob. Verse 10 says, "That day David fled from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath." In desperation, David hides out in Philistine country. Gath, you recall, was the hometown of an unusually tall fellow whom David made a little shorter. About a head shorter, right, to be exact. And David's presence doesn't go unnoticed. The servants of Achish said to him, "Isn't this David the king of the land? Isn't he the one they sing about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." David's reputation precedes him. Whether the people of Gath confuse him as Israel's king or see him as a regional ruler, the irony of this title isn't lost on us. And their suspicion terrifies David, the young warrior. David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. So he pretended to be insane in their presence. And while he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the door of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. What the what? What has become of our king? This is clearly the low point in David's story so far. It gets lower. Right. Achish said to his servants, "Look at this man. He is insane. Why bring him to me? I love this. Am I so short of madmen that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house? The king has enough madmen to deal with. He doesn't need another one wandering around. So he lets David leave. And the next chapter opens with these lonely words. David left Gath and escaped to the cave of Adullam. Do you find yourself in the cave with David today? Rejected and alone? Deflated and disillusioned? Maybe you're grieving. Maybe you're grieving the death of someone you love. Maybe you're grieving the death of a hope you've held that's held you up and held you together. If that's you, my friend, I hope I don't seem calloused. I hope I don't seem crazy. But I hope you let your drama drive you to God. Now, I formulated that phrase intentionally. God wants to be close to you in crisis. God longs to draw you near in drama. But you got a choice to make. You don't have to seek his comfort. And a lot of us don't. We steel our hearts against him. But we don't have to. Remember my story? It's filled with peaks and valleys and everything in between. It's been 10 years since I first did my life plan with Jeff. And as I thought about things this week, looking back over my life, reconsider our work together, my reflection is that I was probably too optimistic when I first put that to paper. In hindsight, I think my valleys dipped lower than I discerned originally. They were dark days indeed. So dark I had trouble seeing God on occasion. But see, the lessons I learned as a child, I carried with me. Even when you can't see him, always seek him. You can do this. I mean it. You can do this. Here's how I know you can do this. I did it. And I was a dumb little kid. I'm serious. I was no child genius. My mom would tell you I was, but I assure you, I was a dork. I grew up in a middle-class family. I went to a tiny little church. I wasn't pastored by Billy Graham or mentored by Mother Teresa. I was just a kid left alone with the Bible. And what did I do? I turned to the Psalms. You can do that. We've studied the Psalms a lot over the years. We've seen there are different genres of Psalms. There are praise Psalms, thanksgiving Psalms, wisdom Psalms, Psalms of trust. Scholars slice and dice the Psalms up differently. But no matter whose list you follow, the largest genre of Psalm is always the laments. The laments are the songs of complaint to God. They're songs of the anxious, songs of the anguished, songs of the attacked. They aren't happy clappy pop songs. They're the blues. And some of them are really fussy. Now, if you're sad, if you're mourning, if you're too depressed or too weary to come up with your own prayers to pray, I want you to pray a psalm. Today I want to hand you Psalm 142. The heading reads, "A maskil of David when he was in the cave, a prayer." I love to learn the background of a song, like Horatio Spafford's "It Is Well," or Martin Luther's "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," or Dolly Parton's 9 to 5. Knowing the story behind the song helps you step into the emotion of the moment and apply the truth to your story. Well, we just read the backstory to Psalm 142. The narrator for Samuel doesn't usually reveal David's thoughts and feelings in his narrative, but thankfully when David was in that cave, he put his prayers to paper in Psalm 142. Wouldn't you like to hear him? Psalm 142, our heading says, is considered a maskil. Now, the meaning of maskil is difficult to pen down. That's why a lot of contemporary translations don't even bother to translate it. They transliterate it. And it looks weird. But it probably is derived from the verb sachal, which means to teach or to instruct, which would make this a psalm of instruction. That means this prayer of David, the prayer that he prayed, is intended to serve as a paradigm, a pattern for our prayers when we find ourselves in similar circumstances. When we find ourselves in the cave, David's prayer can become ours. Maybe you need his prayer today. Remember what's happened. As Saul commands his son and soldiers to kill David, the young warrior has no choice but to flee. He leaves his home, he leaves his wife, he leaves his best friend to live the life of a fugitive. As a fugitive, David loses everything. His military career comes to an end. His ties with Jonathan are severed. His mentor, Samuel the prophet, soon passes away. And even his wife is taken from him. When David flees for his life, Saul gives his daughter to another man in marriage, just to make a point. Virtually overnight, David goes from crowned king to cave dweller. And scholars estimate David spends as long as, get this, 10 years on the run from King Saul. 10 years ducking in and out of caves, being pursued by Saul on the one hand and the Philistines on the other. Imagine 10 years of fear, 10 years of caves, 10 years of questions. Questions like, what about God's promise? What about God's provision? After every encounter with Saul, we'll see David seems driven further from the throne, further from the promise. And it's not fair. It's not fair because throughout David's wilderness wanderings, we see him doing good, defending Israel from foreign invaders, doing Saul's job for him. David was the good Samaritan before there was a Samaria. By the way, that's brilliant biblical humor. Just lost on you. But even when David does something good, David's rewarded with close calls and more caves. Oh, I gotta wonder, what's going through the man's mind? Wouldn't you like to know? Some of you do know. You're all too familiar with the cave. The cave is the season of life when everything comes unraveled. The cave is the place where everything you thought was so clear suddenly becomes dim and uncertain. The cave is where the supports which previously propped you up are knocked away. Some of you are in the cave right now. Your plans and your dreams have been turned upside down. You lost your job. You lost your spouse. You face unprecedented disappointment that's shaken you to your core, and you don't even know what to pray anymore. Well, Psalm 142 gets us into David's head. Psalm 142 allows us to discern what's going on in the mind of the man after God's own heart during a season in which his world has collapsed around him. From the depths of the cave, David prays, I cry aloud to the Lord. I lift up my voice to the Lord for mercy. David's words emphasize that these aren't the quiet prayers of his heart or whispers spoken under his breath. No, these are prayers prayed loudly. I imagine hearing his desperate plea reverberating off the cavernous walls. The verse tells us he seeks the Lord's mercy. This is the Hebrew word chana. Chana is often translated grace. Chana is favor requested when the giver is under no obligation to give it. The name Hannah comes from this Hebrew word, and it means grace. We gave our youngest daughter Morgan the middle name Grace. We almost named her Hannah Grace, but that would make her Grace Grace. So we called her Morgan, which means awesome. It doesn't mean awesome. but she is awesome. Look back at Psalm 142. We could translate verse 1. I lift up my voice to the Lord for grace. David's use of the word reveals, on the one hand, his humility in coming to God. And he knows he's done nothing to deserve God's intervention. But the word also reveals David's belief in God. He trusts God to be a grace-giving God, a generous, compassionate God. He prays, I pour out before him my complaint. Before him, I tell my trouble. Oh, you may find it interesting that David models complaining for us. He does. But the kind of complaining that David does here is not the complaining of the Israelites wandering in the desert in the book of Numbers. Theirs was a faithless complaint that reflected their lack of trust. David's confession reflects faith that God would hear him. The Hebrew word David uses for complaint is sometimes translated meditate when used in a more positive context. This means David is pouring out the depths of his soul to God over and over. He's bringing to God every fear, every worry. He leaves no thought or feeling unspoken. See, the opening verses of Psalm 142 emphasize David's coming to God. He's modeling the point of the passage. Let your drama drive you to him. Psalm 142 is a persistent, incessant prayer of a fugitive. He is relentless in his pursuit of God. He is tenacious. He is stubborn. He is resolute. Here's why. David knows, when my spirit grows faint within me, it is you who watch over my way. When my spirit grows faint, are you weary? Are you exhausted? Are you disillusioned and losing hope? David says, in that moment of despair, God sees everything. Literally in Hebrew, David says, you yourself know my path. In the English Standard Version, we read, when my spirit grows faint within me, it's you who know my way. The Hebrew word translated know is the word yada. It means know. But yada is more than intellectual observation. Yada describes an intimate personal knowledge found through experience. God knows our path because God travels with us even when we can't see him. David's crises have brought him to a point of total exhaustion, but he reminds himself his plight does not escape the attention of God. And he reminds us, when you can't see God, he can still see you. Now that truth might provoke mixed feelings. It seems to bring David comfort. God sees his every step on the path of life. But that information may also be cause for anger. See, if God knows your predicament, why doesn't he do something about it? And if he knows about my despair, why do I have to pray in the first place? I mean, if God sees everything, why do I need to draw his attention to it? Well, 19th century preacher Charles Spurgeon explained it like this. He said, we do not show our trouble before the Lord that he might see it, but that we may see him. David's prayer continues. Verse 3, in the path where I walk, people have hidden a snare for me. Danger lurks on the path. David's enemies intend to trap him. They've concealed the trap so David can't see it. But God can see it. David cries, look and see. There's no one at my right hand. No one is concerned for me. David's alone. His confidants and advocates are long gone. There's no one at my right hand. And the ancient Near East people believed, at your right hand is your greatest support. At your right hand stands your legal counsel. To defend you from your adversaries. David pleads, look to my right. I have no one. In another season of life, David prayed a different prayer. It was a faith-filled prayer. We read it a few weeks ago, Psalm 16, verse 8. I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I will not be shaken. Now that's a prayer that's full of faith. Even when David's alone, he knows God's at his right hand. But in Psalm 142, David doesn't say that. He says to God, as if God doesn't already know, look and see, there's no one at my right hand. Nobody's concerned for me. Now understand what's happening here theologically. practically. Psalm 142 gives us permission to pray different prayers when we're in the cave. See, David is praying his feelings, not the facts. Because David's protest isn't really true, is it? The God of Psalm 16 is the God of Psalm 142. Is it true that God's abandoned him? Well, I don't think it's true. But it is true to David's emotions. And the Bible sometimes presents words and prayers that are more emotional than they are theologically precise. And that's why we find them so helpful when our hearts are broken. That's why we find them so helpful when we're in the cave. The Psalms teach us, pray honest prayers. Prayers that are true to our thoughts and our feelings. I often share this wisdom from C.S. Lewis. We must lay before him what is in us, not what ought to be in us. We got to pray honest prayers. Now, I suppose one could argue someone with a stronger faith than David's might have prayed a different prayer in Psalm 142. But God allowed flawed people with flawed faith to write these prayers because he knew we'd need to pray them too. Well-meaning followers of Jesus often feel guilty if they aren't praying for the missionaries and world peace all the time. But friends, when you're in the cave, sometimes the best prayer for you to pray is a candid complaint. You pour it out. That's what David said in verse 2. He means you empty it. You empty yourself of it. That's what that means. See, that's how you let your drama drive you to God. You pour out your complaint before him. David continues, I have no refuge. No one cares for my life. The storms of life pound me to the ground. There is nowhere I can run for shelter. I am utterly alone. Your cave might be a dark season of loneliness, like David's. Chuck Swindoll writes a vivid and accurate description of loneliness. He says, loneliness is the most desolate word in all the human language. It is capable of hurling the heaviest weights the heart can endure. It plays no favorites, ignores all rules of courtesy, knows neither border nor barrier, yields no mercy, refuses all bargains, and holds the clock in utter contempt. It cannot be bribed. It will not be left behind. Crowds only make it worse. Activity simply drives it deeper. Silent and destructive as a flooding river in the night, it leaves its slimy banks, seeps into our dwelling, and rises to a crest of despair. Tears fall from our eyes as groans fall from our lips. But loneliness, that uninvited guest of the soul, arrives at dusk and stays for dinner. Maybe you know the feeling. David says no one cares for him. But we know this isn't right. From reading the whole story of 1 Samuel, we know David's surrounded by compatriots. A ragtag band of warriors who've gathered around him. You'll hear about him in a few weeks. They care about David. We know that Jonathan, though unable to stop his father's rage, cares deeply for David. Of course, David knows that too, but he doesn't feel that. Can you relate? You can be surrounded by friends and loved ones, but feel completely alone. You may live in a crowd of people, but if those people aren't undergoing the same trials you are, it can feel awfully lonely. Nobody to talk to. Nobody who understands you. Well, maybe, like David, you're crying out from the cave, blinded by your darkness, longing to see the light of day. But my friend, what if something important is happening in that cave? What if somehow the darkness helps you to see? Look, if you spend enough time in the cave, your eyes become adjusted to the darkness, and you will see things that you'd ordinarily miss. From the depths of the cave, David writes, I have no refuge, no one who cares for me. But then, I say to you, O Lord, I say, you are my refuge. I trust the blatant contradiction is not lost on you. Between verse 4 and verse 5, David holds together two incongruous truths. I have no refuge, you are my refuge. This doesn't even make sense. But David's words may not sound odd to you if you've been in the cave with him. See, something special happens in the cave. God does some of the most beautiful things in their cave. Well, there, life gets simple. In the cave, we shift to survival mode. All the crutches on which we normally lean, job, talent, wealth, those crutches no longer provide support. It is then we discover who God really is and what dependence on God really looks like. To paraphrase Eugene Peterson, the cave was the dictionary in which David looked up the word refuge. You see, David let his drama drive him to God. David describes God as my portion in the land of the living. This is a beautiful ancient metaphor. When the people of Israel entered the promised land, each family was assigned an allocation or portion of land. It was from that land the family earned its living, finding provision for countless generations. The land itself signified security and potential for provision. But as I explained a little earlier in this series, one of the 12 tribes of Israel, the Levites, were given no land. The Levites were not called to till the earth for their food. They were a tribe of priests who would be completely devoted to working in the temple. To the Levites, God said, I will be your portion. You will depend upon me for your provision. In the literal sense, the Levites ate from the provision brought in by the offerings of the other tribes into God's temple. But over the generations, the other tribes laid claim to this confession as well. I guess they realized the Levites got the better deal. They recognized the fleeting nature of all other provisions. They realized ultimately God is the source of life. So here in the cave with no land to call his own, David claims God as his portion, knowing he's more than enough. With nowhere else to turn, he resumes his plea. Listen to my cry, for I am desperate, in desperate need. Literally, listen to my noise, David says. Are you desperate like David? He prays in verse 6, rescue me from those who pursue me, for they are too strong for me. Sometimes our problems are bigger than we are. And ourselves, we don't have the wisdom or the strength to endure, much less thrive. Lately, have you caught yourself saying, I can't take anymore? So David prays, set me free from my prison. Do you feel like a prisoner of your problems? Do you feel trapped? No hope of escape? David says, deliver me. Set me free from my prison, that I may praise your name. David knows that if God responds to his cry, he will give God glory and thanksgiving for his graciousness. And not just David will be blessed, but the entire community of God's people will find a greater faith. So the psalm ends in verse 7, then the righteous will gather about me because of your goodness to me. Oh, my friend, may Psalm 142 inspire you to let your drama drive you to God. If you found yourself in the cave, instead of stumbling about with your arms out in front of you, bumping into walls, let your eyes adjust to the darkness for a minute so you can focus on the only one who can turn on the lights. Pray with me. Lord, first I want to pray for my friend here who finds herself or himself in the cave. Lord, would you adjust their eyes to the dim light that they might see you? I pray they would experience you, even through this message. May they sense the gentle squeeze of your hand in theirs, reminding them when they can't see you, you can see them. You've got them. Lord, for my friends in the cave, as their lives grow more difficult, may they grow deeper. May the cave be a place where they are formed, where they find a greater faith than they ever had outside the cave. May you give them comfort. May you give them courage. May you give them strength. And I pray also for my friends who aren't in the cave today. And in fact, maybe this is a season of success. Maybe this is a time of love and joy and peace and the thriving love and life. And Lord, I pray you continue that season. I pray you bless them with really good things. And I pray you remind them of this message. Remind them of Psalm 142. So that they've got in their back pocket if they need it. If life ever thrusts them into the cave. If success turns to failure, if love turns to loss. May they remember these truths that you taught David, that you taught so many of us over the years. And may they let their drum drive them to you, not away. I pray it in the name of the King. Amen. Okay. Friends, let me give you some homework. Here's your first assignment. I want you to pray the Psalms of Lament. Okay? If you don't know what the Psalms of Lament are, first of all, you can just read all of the Psalms. There are 150 of them, and you'll find them. They're pretty easy to find. But honestly, an easy way to do this, there's this thing that the kids are talking about these days. It's called the Googler, and you could just type in Psalms of Lament, and boom, it'll pop up. And you'll find a nice little list. I know. Google it, look for it online. You'll find the Psalms of Lament and start to work through them one by one. Now, not every Psalm will apply to your situation, but just skip that one. Go to the next one and see. Work slowly through these Psalms and see what God teaches you, friends. But here's what I want you to do. I want you to pray particularly through Psalm 142. Now you've read it, you know, since I taught through it, you know what's going on in the text. Pray it for yourself. Make it your prayer, especially if you've run out of prayers to pray in this season. Make it your own, okay? Finally, here's a book for the week. I haven't recommended it for a long, long time. It's one of my favorites on the subject. It's called Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering by Dr. Keller. Wonderful little book that will walk you through some key figures in the Bible who faced suffering, who faced pain. And you get to see what they did and how they handled it, okay? Stand with me. Here's the verse for the week. Psalm 142, verse 3. I read it to you a few moments ago. Take this verse with you. Commit it to memory. Use it in your everyday life. See what God says to you, encourages you. The image on the screen and that graphic I've been showing you both will be available from our website, so be watching for them. If you'd like to receive prayer, there will be some people here at the front to pray for you before you leave. You're welcome to do that. Those of you who are joining us online, you can always send us an email, care@capitalchurch.com, because we'd love to pray for you, especially if you find yourself in the cave. Okay? Especially if you find yourself in the cave. Here's my prayer for all of you, my friends. May you find the faith to allow your eyes to be adjusted in the cave so that you might see him. And may you let your drama drive you to God, so that you might find courage and comfort for whatever crisis you might face. Thanks for coming to church. Grace and peace.